from the seventh canto, chapter 9, text 6. Second, I got it backwards. What? 7, 9, 6.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Saha tat karasparsha. Dhuta Vakila Ashubaha Sapari Abhivyakta Paramatma Darshana Tatpara Padman Vidi Nibrita Bhaga Vrishatkaru Klinarit Ashulochana Satakarasparsha Bhutakila Shubha Supadhyaya Vivyakta Paratma Darshana Tathara Padman Vida Nirvita Dadao Vida Nirvita Rishatanu Klena Rirashu Lochana Satat Karasparsha Dutakina Shubha Sapadhya Vivyakta Paratma Darshanaha Tukhara Padman Vida Nirvita Dado Vida Nirvita Dado Rishatanu Klena Rirashu Lochanaha Satat Karasparsha Dutakila Shubha Sapadhya Vivyakta Paratma Darshanaha Tathara Padman Nirinindita Dava Rishatana Klina Rirashu Lochanaha
Padma,
Because of being touched on the head by the lotus hand of Nrisimhadev. The lotus hand of Nrisimhadev. Duta, being cleansed. Akila, all. Ashubha, inauspicious or material desires. Inauspiciousness. Or material desires. Sapadi. Immediately. Abhivyakta. Manifested. Para Atma Dharshanaha. Realization of the Supreme Soul. Spiritual knowledge. Tapada Padmam. Lord Nrisimhadev's lotus feet. Vridhi. Within the core of the heart. Nirvitaha. Full of transcendental bliss. Dada. Captured. Rishatanu. Having transcendental ecstatic bliss manifest in the body. Klinarit, whose heart was softened due to transcendental ecstasy. Ashu Lochanaha, with tears in the eyes. With tears in his eyes. Translation, Canto 7, Chapter 9, Text 6. By the touch of Lord Nrisimhadev's hand on Prahlad Maharaj's head, Prahlad was completely freed of all material contaminations and desires, as if he had been thoroughly cleansed. Therefore, he at once became transcendentally situated, and all the symptoms of ecstasy became manifest in his body. His heart filled with love and his eyes with tears, and thus he was able to completely capture the lotus feet of the Lord within the core of his heart.
Why don't we repeat?
By the touch of Lord Nrisingadev's hand on Prahlad Maharaja's head. Prahlad was completely free of all material contaminations and desires. Free of all material contaminations and as if he had been thoroughly cleansed. Therefore, he at once became transcendentally situated. And all the symptoms of ecstasy became manifest in his body. His heart filled with love. And his eyes with tears. And thus he was able to completely capture the lotus feet of the Lord within the core of his heart. Completely capture the lotus feet of the Lord within the core of his heart. Purport. Hare Krishna. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, text 26, Mam chayo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sa gunan samatityaitan pamabhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down in any circumstance, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Elsewhere in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text 32, the Lord says, Mani parta bibhasvita ye pisu papajomanaya stira vaishas tata shudras tepi yanti param gatim. O son of Pritha, those who take shelter in me, though they be of lower birth, women, vaishas, as well as shudras, can approach the supreme destination. On the strength of these verses from Bhagavad Gita, it is evident that although Prahlad Maharaj was born in a demoniac family, and although virtually demoniac blood flowed within his body, he was cleansed of all material bodily contamination because of his exalted position as a devotee. In other words, such impediments on the spiritual path could not stop him from progressing, for he was directly in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Those who are physically and mentally contaminated by atheism cannot be situated on the transcendental platform. But as soon as one is freed from material contamination, he is immediately fit to be situated in devotional service. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. You know, Prabhupada many times says that devotional service is not dependent on anything material, and in any situation one can be Krishna conscious. He often makes that point. It's ahaituki apatiyata. It's unmotivated, uninterrupted. That's the nature of it. But Prabhupada also quotes that verse to refer that devotional service is uninterrupted by any material situation. And often he uses Prahlad Maharaj as an example, and here he's using it again because Prahlad Maharaj, as Prabhupada says here, has demoniac blood flowing through his veins. And even though he has demoniac blood in the sense of being born in the family of demons, he's an example of how that situation did not bother him, did not disturb him. And we can think of how often we are disturbed by situations. And these situations have negative effects on our consciousness. And the mistake that we often make, and Prabhupada pointed out this mistake in the letter, is that when our consciousness goes down, we blame it on somebody or something or some situation. Yes? You ever done that? Now, there is truth to that because we have to get the right association. And Mahaprabhu says, if you associate with non-devotees, you'll become contaminated. So we have to balance this. To understand what it means,
Obviously, we seek out the best association and the best environment. But Prabhupada's point is, and this is a philosophical point also in general, that bhakti doesn't depend on anything material. So you can, in essence, be Krishna conscious in any situation. So there's a problem that we used to have quite often, and it probably still exists, that at least early in the movement, that many, many people, when they got married, they found out that it was difficult, at least they experienced that it was more difficult for them to be Krishna conscious. They were no longer living in the Brahmacharya ashram. They were living outside the temple, and then they were often engaged in working outside. So they found this very, very difficult. And some men, finding it difficult, would like Srila Prabhupada and ask if they could get out of household life because they found it, in their words, to be an impediment to my Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada actually got many letters like that. It was a very common phenomenon in those days of young men, mature men. And in one letter, Prabhupada addressed this point directly, and he said, this is the understanding of a neophyte, that his conditions must be perfect, must be ideal for him to be Krishna conscious. So Prabhupada kind of exposed that concept. So if you ever feel that you're in a situation that's not conducive to your Krishna consciousness, at least you can remember this statement of Prabhupada saying, that's the thinking of a neophyte. And I think the point that Prabhupada's making is, when you think, I can only be Krishna conscious in one situation, or this situation which I'm in, I cannot be Krishna conscious, you're restricting yourself. Because you're basically saying, in only one situation and circumstance can I be Krishna conscious. Other circumstances, no. And obviously, that's not true. Does anybody think that's true? Raise your hand if you think it's true, and we'll throw you out the window. It's not true. Now, it seems like it's true, and I have personal experience of this. I was in a situation in which I did not think that I could be Krishna conscious. Externally, it appeared to be pretty much antagonistic to an environment in which you would want to be in to be Krishna conscious. And I learned something, a very valuable lesson, about questions, just like we know Bhagavatam is full of questions. If you ask a good question, you get a good answer. You ask a bad question, you might get a bad answer. So I learned something. And a bad question would be, oh Krishna, why did I end up in this horrible situation where I can't be Krishna conscious? That's a bad question, isn't it? Why is it a bad question? Because it feeds into the misconception that in this situation I can't be Krishna conscious, right? It feeds into it. Why did I end up in such a bad situation? That's what you call a disempowering question. I learned that the proper question to ask is, how can I be, and of course you're asking yourself, which means you're asking Krishna for guidance, how can I be Krishna conscious in this situation which doesn't seem to be conducive to Krishna consciousness? That's an empowering question. Why is it empowering? Because my personal experience is, when you ask empowering questions, Krishna says, oh, he wants an answer. He wants to figure out how to rise to another level. And Krishna gave me an answer. He gave me a very good answer within the situation that I was in. I asked the question, how can I be Krishna conscious? Now, the problem is, I think some of us, when we are in situations which don't seem conducive, which seem antagonistic, we wouldn't even answer the question because we think there is no answer to the question. That it's just, I can't be, and that's the end of the story. So the idea of asking the question is to break that pattern of thinking, this is the only situation where I could be Krishna conscious, and this situation I can't. So now I ask the question, how can I be in this situation? And lo and behold, when you ask that question, Krishna will guide you. He'll show you how you can be Krishna conscious. And then you'll realize Prabhupada's statement that bhakti is a haitukiya pratyata, you can be Krishna conscious in any situation. If that's what you want, if that's what you desire, Krishna will help you. Now, this situation also comes up when you're dealing with a difficult situation, specifically when somebody hurts you. Because when somebody hurts us, what happens? We get hurt. And then what do? We react. And how do we react? Which mode do we react from? Well, it depends which mode you're in. If you're in the mode of goodness, then you'll be like Vishnu, oh, I'm sorry, did you hurt your foot when you kicked me in the chest? So somebody says, you dirty this or that, and you just, in mode of goodness, you just say, I'm sorry, is there anything I can do for you? What did I do? Please forgive me. But most of us don't usually react that way. You react kind of when people throw dirt at you. What do? You pick up a little more dirt and throw it back. That's normal. Actually, they did experiments in which they asked people, put pressure on a person's hand. Just put a little pressure. And so you would get pressure on your hand, and they would say, now put that same amount of pressure back. And they would put more, and they would think they're doing the same. Then it asked this person, now put the same amount of pressure back, and he would press harder, and he would think he was pressing the same. So after a while, they were both pressing very hard, thinking that they were just responding. So we have a tendency to respond when dirt is thrown at us with a little more dirt, and maybe throw it back a little harder. That's the conditioned tendency. So we're in a situation, we've been hurt, or something happened which we don't think is fair. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever said this mantra? It's just not fair. Right, you know. We should have had a certificate along with our birth certificate that said, it's not going to be fair, so don't worry about it when it's not fair. Don't expect it to be fair. You're not in the world where things are going to be fair all the time. So sometimes we're in these situations, something happened, I didn't deserve it, it's not fair, it's not right, it shouldn't have happened, who's in charge here, how can they allow this to go on? Excuse me, there's somebody up there in charge, and it seems like he's allowing it to go on. So the same thing is happening. We're looking in one dimension. We're thinking it's only this way. Just like I was saying before, I'm in a situation and I don't know how to be Krishna conscious. I say it's not a Krishna conscious environment. I'm only looking at it one way. It's one dimensional. So now I'm looking at it one dimensional. This is how it is. You said this, you're a rascal, you're an idiot. I didn't deserve it, you deserve to be hung on a tree. And that's the end of the story. And if I'm really fired up, I'll throw a few shlokas at you, just to like icing on the cake, you know, rub it in, you know. And a few Prabhupada stories, and, you know, a few lectures from my guru, and, you know, like really, like just rub it in, right? So I have another mantra on how you can deal with this. What's going on is something happened, and you perceive it in a particular way, and then you react to your perception. Yes? Okay. So, of course, if something happens to us and we perceive it according to the Bhagavatam, which is, thank you, Prabhu, I really deserve worse than this. Whatever you've done had to be just a fraction of what I deserve. Isn't that what the Bhagavatam says? Isn't that an amazing way to think? How many people think like that? When something bad happens, their immediate reaction is, you know, I actually deserve worse. And whatever I've received is a fraction. Any of you think like that? Raise your hand if you think like that. We have one out of 200. When you're reading Bhagavatam, you think like that. And then when you put Bhagavatam down and you go outside, I mean, you know, it's quite an amazing way to think if you meditate on it, that we are instructed to think this way. But due to our conditioned nature, we don't think this way. Generally, we kind of think, I didn't deserve that, isn't it? I don't deserve to be treated like that. Does anybody feel that we deserve to be treated unkindly or chastised or criticized or cheated out of something? No. So when it happens, our gut response is, I don't deserve it. That somehow or other, that shloka usually doesn't rise to the forefront of our mind and heart, and we don't think, actually, I deserve worse. Like Lord Jesus said, if they slap you in one cheek, give them the other cheek. You know? Yeah. We don't think that way. So we're entering this situation with a conception. This is what happened. You treated me wrongly. You did the wrong thing. I have the shlokas. I have the stories. I have evidence. You did the wrong thing. I didn't deserve this. It was unjust. And therefore, my reaction is going to be based on how I understood it. And if I think I was wrongly treated unjustly, what am I going to do? What's the first thing I'm going to do? Well, I'm going to probably tell that person. And then, who will I tell next? All my friends. How unjustly I was treated. Do you ever do that? Sometimes? That's what we normally do. Well, you never believe what happened. I can't believe it. You know, this movement. You know, he calls himself a devotee. Could you believe that? He's acting like this. We're upset. And so, naturally we're upset. So, I have a mantra. A very powerful mantra. Which will help us put Prabhupada's instruction into practice. And the mantra is, we have an idea what it means. He's wrong, I'm right, it's unjust, I've been cheated, whatever it is. The mantra is, what else could it mean? What else could... Is that the only thing it means? Obviously, what else it could mean, the first thing we could think of is, I deserve it. How many of you, raise your hand, believe in the law of karma? Okay, so why when somebody unjustly treats you, that's not the first thing that comes to our mind? It's amazing, isn't it? It's one of the most amazing phenomena of the Hare Krishna movement. That when we're mistreated, the first thing that comes to our mind is not that this must be my karma. The first thing that comes to mind is it's his fault. Isn't it strange? Don't you find that strange? So, what else could it mean? Maybe it's my karma. Maybe he didn't mean it. Maybe he's having a bad day. Maybe his wife just screamed at him, and now he's like really upset, and he's like, he's going to shoot somebody, you know, whoever gets in his way. They're going to get it from him. Right? That's another story. Or maybe Krishna sent this person to teach me tolerance. Maybe he sent this person to teach me humility. It could mean so many things. Just a powerful mantra. What else could it mean? Because our philosophy is teaching us to look at the world transcendentally, because we tend to look at it generally from the modes of nature and often from passion and ignorance. So if you see it from passion and ignorance, you develop an understanding based on passion and ignorance, which will only cause us to react from passion and ignorance. Does that make sense? Because that's what you think happened, right? Let me tell you a story. It's a really funny story. So in 1982, I was the temple president of Mauritius. And Mauritius was a very, very poor country at that time. So in poor countries, there's a lot of stealing. It's just some people have to steal to make ends meet, right? So I used to keep money in a drawer in my office. And one fine day, I opened the drawer and there was no money in it. And that very day, one of the brahmacharis ran off with one of the brahmacharinis into the Mauritian sunset. It was a beautiful scene. Music was playing. Beautiful beach, white sand, turquoise water, yeah. But unfortunately, the money was gone at the same time. So, you put two and two together, you get four, right? So we hunted him down and we found him. Because it's a small island and you're only two or three phone calls away from finding anybody at any time. And if you want to know what anybody's doing, you can find out. Actually, you don't even have to try to find out. Someone will tell you. So, we were told, do you know one of your brahmacharis and brahmacharinis are walking together on the beach? You know, we found that out like a day later. So, anyway, you know, we finally got them back and we said, where's the money? And he said, what money? We said, well, you know, all the money in my drawer is gone and you left. And he kept saying, pleading innocent. And I said, that you can't be innocent, you're lying, I want the money back. He said, no, I didn't take the money. He refused to admit he took the money, right? So, you want to know what happened? This is interesting. And it's also good if you're ever in the judicial process, you know, to not jump to conclusions. Well, it was summer vacation or some vacation, and there was this young boy staying. He probably was 11 or 12, right? And he was cleaning the temple. He cleaned my office, this and that. And so he comes every morning to the temple. And one morning he came with this new expensive watch. It's like, okay, sit down here, young man. We call his parents up. Do you know anything about this watch? And they said, what watch? He said, he's wearing a very expensive watch. They said, we know nothing. So they come and they talk to him, and we find out he took the money out of the drawer. Not the brahmachari who ran off with the brahmacharini, which, you know, when you run off with a brahmacharini, it's always good to take a little money with you, because you're going to need it, and you're going to need a lot more in the future, so, you know. And after all, he was a Sankirtan devotee, so, you know, Sankirtan devotees think, oh, I collected so much money for ISKCON, you know, what do they give me? I can take it. You know? So that was our story, and our story resulted in punishing this. We're trying to punish this poor brahmachari. Anyway, we found the unlikely candidate was a little innocent boy who stuck his nose in the drawer and took the money. Anyway, he returned his watch, we got our money back. But as you can see, the point is, we come up with a story and then we base our whole life on the story and then we react in certain ways. So, Bhagavatam has so many stories to teach us how to act in proper ways. And if you think about it, you look at all the stories of Bhagavatam and you see, oh, here's a situation that's maybe similar to what we're going through. Right? And how do the devotees react? How do the sadhus react? And also in Bhagavatam you have how the ordinary people react. Right? So we have here Prahlad. How did he react when his father was killing him? That's an example. Now, I don't know if you know this, but if your parents abuse you, at least in America, you can take them to court. Did you know that?
You can do that even if they didn't abuse you.
You can do that, and you can just say that they did, right? They deprived you of your chocolate candy, I'm going to take them to court, right? Psychological abuse. Yeah, so I think Hiranyakashipu was the original Adi child abuser, and Prahlad Maharaj was the Adi abused child. What do you think? Yeah. How did he react? Interesting, huh? The point is, it's a lesson. You, if you're a kid, your parents are sometimes going to do or say something you don't like, isn't it? How do you react? So actually, if you look at Bhagavatam, you'll see any situation we're going to be in, there's a story, and it's a guideline how to react. To ask that question, what else could this mean, and go through your mind, Bhagavatam. So that was an introduction to today's verse. And now I want to talk a little bit about something else, which I think is really important. In this story, If you remember what's happening, Lord Nrisimhadeva is very angry. And they're trying to pacify him. And Brahma's intelligent. And Brahma knows that, he knows the heart of Krishna, and the heart of Krishna is what? That Krishna is moved by love. He's pacified and controlled by love. So Brahma, he's intelligent, isn't he? You agree? At least four times more intelligent. than most people, or how many heads he has. Plus, he's already the most intelligent anyway. So Brahma, in all universes, in this past time, Brahma is a devotee, so he understands the philosophy. So Brahma thinks, I can't pacify him because I don't have that much love. And even Lakshmi can't pacify him because she doesn't have that much love. And the only way to pacify him is to put someone in front of him who has love, because Krishna will be pacified by love. Yes? So he was smart, and he put Prahlad in front of Krishna. Because Prahlad had, he put Prahlad in front of Nrsimhadev, and because Prahlad had love, what happened? Immediately, Nrsimhadev just, as we say in California, he was chill. He chilled out, right? Immediately. What chilled him out? It was the love, wasn't it? And now, when Nrsimhadev touches him, and the love just starts to boil over, and he's experiencing ecstatic symptoms. So what I thought was important, we have about 13 minutes left. So what I thought was really important to talk about love, and especially because Prabhupada said something that I think for many of us is confusing and also not politically correct, because of course Prabhupada was representing Gaudiya Vaishnavism, not political correctness. So when we hear things, being raised in our culture, we hear things that aren't politically correct sometimes. It's like, ah, oh, it doesn't feel right. And Prabhupada said something that could even seem to undermine normal human relationships. And what was that he said? He said, in the material world, there's no love. How does that make you feel? The brahmacharis are like, yeah! No love. That gives them the strength for renunciation, you know. And the women are like, oh, how could he say that? He's so hard. So, isn't it? And then you'll fall somewhere in the middle, right? Isn't it? It's a heavy statement, and I think we need to talk about it and understand what Prabhupada meant by that. And I want to tell you something from the Damodara Lila that's like completely amazing. And it defines love. And I think the reason we may misunderstand this statement is because we're not defining love clearly as we should, so that we can distinguish the love between Krishna and his devotees and the love we have in this world. Now, before I tell you this amazing story, which will make you faint and swirl and cause you to become ecstatic, just hold on, it's coming. I want to tell you a story. Early in the movement, Prabhupada described prearranged marriages, and I know in my generation I never heard of such a thing. I was from California. California's a liberal place. Maybe if you grew up in the south of, or some very Christian part of the world, maybe you know about arranged marriages. But I grew up in Los Angeles. That's Hollywood. That's kind of, you know, about as liberal as it gets, more or less. It's about as west as it gets. Krishna West started in Los Angeles. You know. So that's like as west as you can go. So, you know, Prabhupada had a servant. He was also from California, San Francisco, and that's even more liberal. And he said, Prabhupada, if the marriage is arranged, how do they develop love? I mean, he was completely confused, because who in the West marries somebody if they don't love them? It's just that idea is like, huh? Isn't it? It doesn't make any sense. Why would you marry someone if you don't love? Let's find two people that don't love one another and put them together. That's a good idea, right? So that's how he was thinking. So Prabhupada said, so how do they love, develop love? Prabhupada said, love? He said, love is for Krishna. And just, you know, like, what are you talking about, love? So, you know, we hear these things, and it's like, okay, we have to clarify what Prabhupada means. So I want to tell you this story, because it's an amazing story. Now, I'll tell you a couple of stories, because I want to illustrate the love that Prabhupada's talking about. You know in Damodar Lila that Krishna was put down because the milk was boiling over and Mother Yasoda had to attend to the milk, and she was attending to the milk, and that's Krishna's milk. So it's for Krishna. So she put Krishna down, she went to the kitchen to take the milk off the stove. You know what happened while she was in the kitchen? She put Krishna down, she went to the kitchen, and she was feeling separation from Krishna. How far was the kitchen from where she was? She could see Krishna in the courtyard. She was feeling separation just to put him down and go. And Krishna was feeling separation because now his mother had left him. That's kind of unusual, don't you think? Yes? No? No? Yes? I mean, you know, you put your little baby down in the crib and you go in the kitchen to boil some milk and you're manifesting emotions of intense feelings of separation. That's unusual. Now, what is even more unusual, just as a side point, add some icing to this. Krishna was jealous of Yasoda because he could see her separation for him was greater than his separation for her, and he was jealous. She gets to feel more separation than I do. That's just a side point. Okay, so now, after the trees fell down, nobody actually knew that Krishna was tied up. They had all left. They had all gone to a festival. And nobody knew that Krishna was tied up, right? And when they all came out, because they heard the explosion of the trees, and they all came out, they wanted to know what happened, and these trees fell over, what happened. And Krishna thought, I've already been chastised once for stealing butter. Now they're going to see this mortar knocked over the trees, they're going to chastise me again. I don't want to deal with it. So Krishna and the boys, they hid under the trees, because the trees are full of leaves and branches. So all the parents, everybody came out, and they were just looking at the trees. And Krishna and the boys were invisible. They were under the trees. They couldn't find them. And it was only when Yasoda came out, the first thought Yasoda had was, where's Krishna? Nobody even thought to ask where Krishna was. But Krishna was afraid to come out because he thought, they're going to chastise me, and I've already been chastised once. But Krishna could feel the love of his mother, and that love of his mother controlled him so much that he just came out. He had to come out. But something amazing happened at this time. When he came out, he was still angry. He manifested anger that I'm tied to this mortar. He was really, really angry. You know, how could you tie me to this mortar? And then Nanda Maharaj saw that he's tied to this mortar. He's like, what happened? Who tied Krishna to this mortar? So he found it was Yasoda. And then Yasoda saw that the trees had fallen, and she thought, oh my God, these trees could have fallen on Krishna and killed him. I was the one who tied him up. So, and then Nanda's looking at Yasoda, and it's like, he gives her a look like, you did this? You tied this boy up? And all of this, what happened was, all of this was weighing heavy on Yasoda, and she became overwhelmed by guilt. And she just moved to the back. She couldn't even see Krishna. She couldn't even deal with the fact that she had done this. And now Nanda Maharaj is looking at her and saying, how could you do this? So it's just rubbing it in. And now Nanda Maharaj goes to the front. He looks, you know, can I untie this? She goes, yeah, okay. So he unties it. Another side point, as you remember, Krishna got all the ropes in the whole village and they were too short. You remember that? And do you know how Yasoda, not Krishna, Yasoda got all the ropes, it's too short. You know how she finally tied him? She pulled a tie out of her hair. That was how she tied him. And the churning rod rope was the rope that she tied around the mortar. And then she tied that. Now, an interesting thing happened. Well, you know why she tied her, because Krishna said, okay, I love you and you want to tie me. But you know what happened? After Nanda Maharaj took, untied the rope, that one little hair tie which tied him, all the ropes all of a sudden showed up on the ground. Somehow all the ropes had merged into that tie, and when he took it off, they were all there. Piles and piles and miles and miles. Anyway, so now Nanda Maharaj enters the scene. He takes over. Mother Yashoda is behind the scene. And this whole rasa is going on between Nanda, the father, and the son. And Krishna's mad at his mother.
What my mother did, she tied me up. How could she do that?
And this whole scene's going on. And Yashoda is so embarrassed and feeling so guilty. And on top of that, she feels a disapproval of Nanda, but she feels what's in Krishna's heart, because what's ever in Krishna's heart, she can feel it. And so she feels his anger. And she goes away into her room, and she locks herself up for 3 days. And there in the house, everything's going on, and she won't come out. And Krishna's, you know, feeling this anger, and she feels it. And they're calling her, come out, come out, and she won't come out. And she's just feeling horrible, horrible. So for those 3 days, she's feeling separation from Krishna. Could you imagine what she's feeling? And could you imagine what Krishna's feeling? And Krishna starts to empathize and feel her misery and what he's doing to her by being angry at her. And he can't tolerate it anymore. And all of a sudden, all his affection goes to Mother Yashoda, and she feels it at that moment. She feels his affection, and she comes out. And this is the way the Shastra describes it. It said, if you took all the happiness in the universe and you multiplied it 1,000,000 times and took, that could not match one drop of the happiness Yashoda was feeling. And if you took all the love in the universe and you multiplied it 1,000,000 times, that could not equal one drop of the love Krishna was feeling for Mother Yashoda. Very heavy scene. They unite after 3 days. Can you imagine what it's like? Now, when Prabhupada says there's no love in the material world, what does he mean? There's no love like that. That does not exist in the material world. That's what he means. Do you love your wife? Do you love your husband? Do you love your children? Do you love your God, brothers, sisters? Of course you do. Do you love them like this? It's not possible. This love is special. That's what Prabhupada means. So when he says love, love is for Krishna. That's prema, that's real love. So I just wanted to tell that story, and I wanted to clarify that that is the love that Prabhupada's talking about when he says there's no love. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, jai Gaur Premanandi, Hari Hari Bol. So, if you have any questions, why don't you just come up to the front so we can let everybody go. You can ask him privately. Yes. Hare Krishna. It's him.